Our speaker for today will be Thomas R. McFall, and he is the author, along with Al Brunstein, God and Randomness. And his book is for sale in the back, so be sure and pick up one before you leave, right on the table there, and I'm sure he'd appreciate your support. It's brand new. I mean, you can just feel it. Amen. Smells brand new right after press. Hey, right. So I welcome to you today, Mr. Thomas R. McFall. We're going to be dealing with science and scripture.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, man.
Golly, it's great to be back. Wow. This is just terrific. Yeah, it's really, really, really wonderful to see so many people I've seen so many times, and to be reassured you're still coming back, as they say. Al will be here next week. Al Brunstein will be here for 2 weeks. We have a six-week series on our new book. Last time we were here, we did God is Here to Stay, and you were all very, very supportive of our participation in that event. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about how this new book came about. And I appreciate Jeremiah for pitching it, as they say. But if you do want some books, there are available here. But this book is a sequel to the other book. It's not a new theme. It's within the science and faith genre in the area. And I want to talk a little bit about how it came about. So, but the way I'd like to begin, if you look up on the screen, I hope everybody can see the screen, where it talks about this being a sequel to the book we published in 2014. Now, the book is an interesting title, and we've chosen it specifically to highlight the word random, all right, randomness. And this is the reason we chose that particular idea, word, general area, and that is for this reason. When we wrote God is Here to Stay, we were taking a careful look at the structure of the universe in six specific areas that ranged all the way from the Big Bang right on down to some contemporary issues. And in that particular book, we juxtaposed the word random with the word meaning in this sense. You'll see in the lower right-hand corner, if you recognize the art of Van Gogh, this is my favorite painting of all paintings. It represents the universe in all of its splendor. And in the first book that we wrote, God is Here to Stay, we asked the question this way. Did all of this beautiful universe that we enjoy so much come about as the result of the work of an intelligent creator whom we call God? Or is it merely random? Has no purpose, has no inherent meaning. It just evolved out of chance alone from the time the universe began in the Big Bang, which was 13.8 billion years ago. We accept the modern science interpretation of the way in which our universe came into existence and how it evolves. And we recognize the other alternative points of view. And the purpose of the book is, the first book was not to argue one or the other, but to look hard at evidence. And we concluded that the universe is structured in such a way that we can feel very confident that the universe was brought into existence and evolved as a result of the work of God, intelligent creator. So defining randomness by chance alone, which is the second to the last line in this particular slide, is our starting point. Now, after that, when Al was down here last time, we went to the Perot Museum. And we were wandering through that museum. I suspect most of you, is this correct assumption, have at least been there or certainly know about it. There's a special hall in there called the Expanding Universe Hall. And Al and I were just marveling, as were our spouses, marveling. Sally is here today. Sally is right over there. And Joyce will be here next week, too. And we were just marveling at this wonderful expansion of our universe and also of the scientists who made their contributions with regard to our understanding of how it happened and so on. And when we were done, we heard this question over our shoulders. What do you mean by random. Little did we know that there was a student who was following us through that Expanding Universe exhibit. And we realized at that time we must have been using the word random over and over again to describe how the universe was evolving. Now, that in itself was a random event. Wasn't planned. The student was there. And we never got her name. And we had about a 5 or 10 minute conversation with her, exploring from her. It was a teachable moment for everybody. And we were the students, and she was as much the teacher as vice versa. We never got her name, but in those particular 10 minutes, we got an idea for a new book. That one random event is the inspiration for this new book. When we realized that the word randomness can be used in multiple ways is the way to enter into the topic. And so what we wanted to do was look at the concept of randomness in a broader perspective. And in fact, not just a broader perspective, but from a very different perspective than the one we have used in the two books. So in the first book, we thought of randomness as merely by chance alone. In the second book, we are exploring it in detail, and we realize that this highly structured universe of ours, whom we believe was brought into existence by God, includes a great deal of random events that happen all the time. And then we raise the question, what is the relationship of God to these random events as we understand them and as they occur in our lives all the time? Any of you who heard Paul Rasmus this morning, terrific sermon. If you have a chance, well, to get to it and listen to it and so on. He deals with the issue of David and how many events in David's life were really, in some sense, randomly caused. He was responsible for a lot of what happened, but what happened to him had a great deal of unpredictability and uncertainty about it. So as we began this book, the first thing we decided to do was to take a look at various views of randomness. How do people use it over and over again? And then what will our definition be? And then gradually, slowly but surely, the book unfolds with our attempt to show where randomness occurs throughout the universe in 6 different areas. And then in the last chapter, to draw some conclusions with regard to how God relates to this randomness, this sort of unpredictability. And we started with the idea of causality. For example, you've got a couple of slides up here. The first one, which if you have children, is a lesson we've taught all of our children from the beginning. Don't touch that hot stove because it's predictable what's going to happen. That child is going to burn his or her fingers. That's called determinism. Determinism as opposed to indeterminism. And there are many, many events that occur throughout our universe that are, quote unquote, determined to happen. If you sit under an apple tree like Isaac Newton did, guess what's going to happen? Sooner or later, that apple does what? Falls on your head. That's how we discovered, or legend has it, the law of gravity. If you jump off a 10-story building, which I do not recommend, by the way, you will always fall at the same speed. Is guaranteed. It is determined. There are so many things that happen in our lives that are like that. But there's also, as you'll see under 4B here, a great deal of indeterminism. Things that happen by probability alone that we cannot totally predict in advance, but we can be making some assertions about the potential occurrence of an event in terms of probabilities. Shall we go on that picnic? I'm not sure. Listen to the weathercast. We have a 40% chance of rain today. Doesn't say 100% chance. It's not totally predictable. It is probable that it will rain 40%. In fact, if I am correct in the weathercast today, the rain is supposed to start today at about noon. And the probability of its occurring is, guess what? 40%. Now, this changes. Now, if I were going on a picnic today, I'd say, is this the right day to go on a picnic? Should we do it some other day or will we get rained out? But life is filled with all kinds of unpredictable, so that is probable events. So our lives consist of, on the one hand, causalities that are predeterministic. That is, they're just going to happen, and others that are not so deterministic,
that operate more in the area of uncertainty rather than certainty. We call it probability. So this is where we start. Now, beyond this point, we have four ways in which we then deal with the question of randomness, and then we draw a conclusion that transitions to the next chapter. This is still on the first chapter, all right? The way to understand determinism in the universe and indeterminism in the universe is to really go back to physics. That's why this is science and faith, because what we understand about how the universe works in terms of probabilities and certainties is all related to the evolution of the field of quantum physics, or of physics in general, of which quantum is a part. Now, you'll notice there are a couple of graphics up here. This is classical versus quantum physics. Gravity is classical physics. That is, you can predict something will happen. It's going to happen, and the universe is filled with all kinds of events that we know will happen, and they are highly predictable. When we send somebody into orbit to orbit the moon and come back safely, as Neil Armstrong and his crew did, that is a highly predictable event. It doesn't mean there aren't contingencies that could make it very unpredictable, as happened in Flight 13, Apollo 13, and so on. But we know enough about the mathematics of the universe to know it's predictable in a highly deterministic way. Back in the 1930s and the 40s, when physicists began experimenting with what we now know of as atom smashing, what's going to happen to the atom once it explodes out of nuclear energy, ideas come out of this experimentation and so on, it was discovered by Heisenberg and his colleagues that they couldn't predict the right trajectories and speed of protons and neutrons as they collided, as the atoms collided and smashed each other and scattered. This was where the idea of quantum universe begins to emerge. The idea that the universe is in fact filled with probabilities as much as it is certainties. And there's a lot that happens in our lives that is associated with the certainties of classical physics, and a lot that are associated with the probabilities or uncertainties of quantum physics. Here's one example. When you're born, when I'm born, my height potential is already determined by what? Those genes that are within me. I'm never going to be 6 feet. You know, and if I want to play left tackle for the Dallas Cowboys, it ain't going to happen. I don't have the genes to make it happen. Now, that is highly predictable in the genetic structure. What is not predictable is the genes that I'm going to get before I'm conceived. And only after I'm conceived does that genetic structure that is in each one of us, the 30,000 genes or so, and the 3 billion pairs that come out of those 30,000, is it then, in some sense, predetermined? But prior to that, what happens before the moment of conception is highly improbable in terms of which of those sperms is going to get to the egg and fertilize it. It's a very improbable set of circumstances. And much of what we get in terms of our aptitudes, right, and our abilities and so on are related to this improbabilities or uncertainties. Let me give you an example. I have a good friend who's tone deaf, can't tell one note from the other. And I ask him, would you sing Happy Birthday for me? And here's what he does. Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday, dear Tom. I said, okay, that's good. And I said, now let me sing it back to you to see if I've gotten it right. And I say, happy birthday to you, happy birthday, the way we all do it. He says, yeah, that's what it sounded like for me. And I said, no, sir, it didn't. You're tone deaf. He doesn't hear it. When I was in college, one of the co-eds that I dated had perfect pitch. Perfect pitch. And you never had to
what? Look at a piece of paper and then go over it again and again to memorize the music. She could look at the scale and sing it right out because she had this perfect pitch. And when we were walking together down the street and a car would honk the horn, she'd say, "That's an F sharp." I would say, "I don't want to hear it." Because I couldn't prove it. I couldn't prove it or disprove it. I didn't have a little tuning fork that I was going to measure it against, and I just took her word for it. And here is a person, for example, who had the skill and ability, and that's something she got by birth as well. It just happens to be there when she's born, like Ray Charles and Mozart and so many other people who had these extraordinary abilities, and my friend who can't sing a note. They once tried to recruit him for a choir, and the choir director after the first night said, "Howard, come over here, we have to talk." Wonderful guy. Okay, see, so our experiences are a combination of classical and quantum behaviors and their effects in certainty and unpredictability as well. Now, here is the first way we define it. This is called the bell curve or the normal curve. And unfortunately, there's a little bit of overlap. And the bell curve, I've looked at it from two points of view. And I'll start with the one on the right where it says low performers, average performers, high performers. If you get 1,000 people and they're all born at the same time, it's impossible to predict in advance who will be the most athletic and skilled. When you think of what we're going through with the Olympics right now, these are talented people who are born with this skill. Now, they have to develop it. They have to develop it through rigorous training, but they would be up here, I can walk over here, on this end of the bell curve. Over here on the far right. These are the, now take weight or height, for example. This is another way to say it. If you took all the men in this room and did an average of your height, what would the average male be in here? Average. It would be 5'9". That is now the national average. If you did it for all the women, it would be 5'7". Is now the average, 6 or 7. Now, if you were born in the 13th century, the average height for a man was 5'5", not 5'9". So we have grown this way 4 inches, and women have also, all right? Now, if you take the curve on the left, right in the middle, the peak of the curve is 5.9. As you come down the right slope, and there are 3 standard deviations, any of you who have ever studied statistics will know this right away. If you get out here on plus 3 deviations or standard deviations, these are people who are 7 feet tall. They're the tall ones. And there are not a lot of them. But if you're tall and have athletic ability, you can become a pretty good athlete or a basketball player. And most of the basketball players have to be that tall. There, you don't find a lot of 5-foot basketball players out there. But there are a number of people here who are 5 foot tall or less. And they become great snowboarders at the Olympics. Some of them, and the skiers can be small. They do not have to be big people to develop those skills. If you want to be a football player, you have to be a big person or have extraordinary speed ability in certain kinds of muscle twitch, they call it, and so on. The majority of us will fall in the middle here. Then there will be the low performers who can't sing a note, are tone deaf, and those who have perfect pitch, and those of us in the middle who can sing in our church choir. How many here sing in the church choir or have sung in church choirs before? Quite a few people, actually. I'm one of them. I'm in the middle. I'm right here. Now, 2/3, this is the way it works. 2/3 are 1 plus 1 standard deviation minus standard deviation. Then 2/3, then this is 94%, and then finally 99%. That covers virtually everybody. Now that's, think of it this way. When a new baby is being born, we don't know what that person's potential is going to be yet. And only as that person begins to develop over time will we find out where that person is going to be on this scale. So you can measure weight, height, some other factor. Now, if you work for insurance companies, this is the way you operate. because you have to determine what the costs of policies will be, as well as the payout that's going to come as a result of insurers' injuries and deaths and so on. And working for an insurance company, one could say something like this. We think that 10% of the population, I'm just saying this hypothetically, will get cancer during this coming year, and 8% of them will die. 2% will go into remission or will not, but they can't do what? They can't tell you exactly which people are going to fall in that 10%. It's all done in terms of what? Probability. Uncertainty. And they even miss on the probability of how many people may die, let's say, from automobile accidents. And they make their projections of policy premiums and payouts on the basis of what are called the actuarial tables. And the way they put those actuarial tables together is they go back and look at the last 10 years to see what the trends in deaths and accidents and payouts and so on are, and that's how they determine your premium is for the coming year. It's all done in terms of statistical probability, uncertainty, and if you think of it this way, unexpected events that occur in the lives of all of us. So that's the first one. We have to look at normal distribution. The second one's permutations. And correlations is the third one. And permutations refer to how multiple factors in any given situation can be combined in different ways to produce different and often unexpected results. Here are some examples. There are two little children down on the lower left-hand corner. John looks like his mother and Jane looks like her father. We don't know that in advance. How many times have somebody said to your children, you look like your dad? And they say, well, I'm not sure I do. Well, I see a little bit in there. You look like your mother. That's unpredictable. And that happens not through certainty, but through probabilities. Here's another statistic. When a child of, say, 100 children are born, 98% of them will fall into this normal range in the statistical normal distribution we call the bell curve. 2% will fall outside of it. And no matter how many medical interventions we make, as well as treatments, 2% of all children who are born usually have some form of medical challenge that they confront, that the parents necessarily have to deal with. That 2%. So when parents have children, the probability of having a normal child is 98%. But there are many children who are born with severe challenges, which can be physical as well as mental and so on. And a lot of it has to do with the inheritance, the tendencies to develop a certain kind of genetic predisposition for the 4,000 genetic diseases that are out there are given in the genetic structures that children inherit from their parents. Highly improbable kinds of activities. Also, new species, number two up here. Where do new species come from? Well, this is, we don't know. All we know is that new species appear. And the latest thinking is that what we have, let's say we have 100 factors in any particular situation out of which a certain consequence will come. Our minds are like a little circle inside a larger circle. And our mind can't possibly comprehend all of the possibilities that are associated with the combinations and correlations of factors in there. And we may not even have access to knowledge of some of them, and all of a sudden something appears on the evolutionary timescale, and we say, my goodness, where did that come from? And we try to understand as much as we can, and what we know of is there's a great deal of happened historically and through the evolutionary process that was unpredictable. It just showed up. And another one says, well, how did the dinosaurs disappear? There are two great theories on that. Nobody knows for sure because we can't go back and duplicate the circumstances, but it's assumed the dinosaurs disappeared about how many million years ago? 65 million years ago, exactly correct. I saw your lips move. Right, right, very good, very good. You come up here now, you get to teach the rest of the morning. No. What caused it? The two great theories are asteroid hit the Earth and the other one is volcanoes exploded. But the key is to cover the sky with ash so the Earth darkens and sunlight can't get through.
all of the vegetation on the Earth disappears for a short period of time, and the dinosaurs can't get vegetation. And if dinosaurs can't get vegetation, the dinosaurs that eat dinosaurs have nothing to eat because the vegetation dinosaurs die. That means ultimately they all die. But the cockroach didn't. The cockroach had a way to protect itself. The humble little cockroach has been around for almost 200 million years. Think of it. That's pretty tough stuff. Yeah? Okay. We modern humans have been here about 200,000, which I'll get to later. So this is all probable. We're all working in the theory of probabilities. Now, there's a fourth way to understand this, and that is through the human mind. About 200,000 years ago, something really, truly amazing began to happen on the face of the Earth. And we call ourselves modern humans or Homo sapiens, emerged with the capacity for choice. There's very few other species that have that kind of capacity that we have. We call it free will. And the result is that we can think of alternative courses of action before choosing the one that we want. And we do it all the time in our lives. All the decisions that we make, major decisions, involve reflecting on the nature of alternative possibilities. We don't just react instinctively like ants and bees do, who are born with those instincts to function in their hives and their so on together as a group. We plan our futures, we create culture, and we don't live by instinct alone. We live by mind, thinking, cognition. If you think of it that way, mental processes that involve free choice. So, choice increases uncertainty. It doesn't diminish uncertainty and lead to more probability. It makes for greater improbability. So we live in four different worlds. The first one is there's certainty with determinism. We have no choice. That's gravity. We obey the laws of gravity, and if we don't, it is to our peril. All right? Way to think of it. Another one is uncertainty with regard to no choice. Atoms don't have uncertainty with regard to choice. They just happen in an atom-smashing environment. If you throw a baseball off a 10-story building, the baseball doesn't think, let me see, I think I'll go up instead of down. I think I'll go sideways. The baseball doesn't have a choice, but somebody standing on a 10-story building has the choice to what? To throw it or not to throw it. And that's the result of having free will that the baseball does not have. The third one here is called certainty with choice. It's like throwing a baseball, the lower left-hand corner. When the pitcher goes out on the mound, pitchers expect to throw the baseball. Now that is called certainty with choice, because the pitcher can be out there or not be out there. And if the pitcher is not out there, then that's a determinism, excuse me, that's an indeterminism that the coach would make. You don't pitch today, you pitch. So when the second of the pitchers goes out there, the second of the pitchers makes a choice. All right, here's the choice. I'm a pitcher. The catcher is right down there where Fred is. And Fred gives me the signal. Now I have a choice. Choice is he gives me usually a finger down one, which is down. What does that mean? You ever play catcher? I was a catcher in high school. So what does it mean? Fastball. He wants a fastball. I agree to that, rather than shake it off. You ever see these pitchers shake it off? That's all what? That's all indeterminism. They think they know what the best pitch is for the batter. So let's say he gives me a finger two, which is a curve, and then I say finger one, yes, and then he goes to the inside or the outside. I then throw the ball. That is certainty with choice. I have to throw it after I've made a decision, and the certainty is that I will throw it once I make the decision. Make sense? Make sense? Okay. The next one is uncertainty with choice. And when I throw it, if the count is 3-2, guess what might happen? I might strike them out. It might be ball 4. Or they might what? They might hit it. Exactly right. What makes the Olympics so fun to watch is what? We don't know who's going to win. We don't know who's going to win because it's probability. Think of this Czech skier who was ranked 43rd in the world. And she ends up what? Winning the gold medal. On somebody else's skis. Now, who'd have thunk it? You know, who'd have thunk it in advance? What makes it so wonderful, and this is what Paul Rasmussen said this morning, is the improbabilities that are associated with extraordinary accomplishments that people make in the Olympics and rise to the occasion after coming out of certain events that were improbably caused in a negative sense, and yet they were able to put their lives back together in a training program that made all of that possible. And then they go to the Olympics not knowing who's going to win, and all of a sudden they end up either a winner or not doing as well as they were expected to do, like Lindsey Vonn, right? Or this guy called Nathan Chen. I don't know if you saw him, but he did 6 quads in his ice skating event. You know, nobody's ever done that. He didn't fall down on one of them, and yet he still didn't win. The young Japanese skater won, who won 4 years ago, and he went through a terrible accident where he broke his ankle, and they didn't know whether he would recover. It's the same story over and over again of how improbable events occur. They can be good as well as bad. Many of you have read the book, I suspect, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. But what about when good things happen to good people? Or good things happen to bad people? Or bad things happen to bad people? There are actually 4 combinations. And a lot of it has to do with randomness, but we focus on when good things happen to, or bad things happen to good people, because we wonder why would that happen in God's world of goodness. That's all probability and randomness. All right. When it comes to non-causality, there are really only two possibilities. We believe that everything that happens in the universe has a cause of some kind. We may not understand that cause, but our perspective is that the universe is filled with certainty causes as well as uncertainty or improbable causes. What we don't understand when something happens and can't explain it causally is, where did that come from? How did this happen? Like this terrible tragedy in Florida, we now understand the mental illness that Nicholas Cruz had before going into that terrible environment. But and apparently there were all sorts of signs out there. And now we're in the process of retroactively trying to find out why didn't somebody connect the dots before this happened, and especially who do we need to talk to try to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. There's a lot of improbability, a lot of speculation around 9/11. There was all kinds of information out there that Al-Qaeda was trying to do something dramatic and big. And much of the speculation after 9/11 happened that killed 3,000 people is, why didn't they connect the dots? The information was all out there. The information is not clear. It's called the noise in the environment. And there can be a way of combining all sorts of factors that can lead to good outcomes as bad outcomes. And the difficulty is to try to make a 100% prediction in advance as to which way it would go. And the universe is filled up with all kinds of events that happened to us that were unpredictable in advance. Here's one of my favorite stories. I always love to ask people, how did you meet your spouse? How did you meet your spouse? Most of them were completely unplanned. I went to a party. My friend had another friend there who introduced me to a third friend. And guess what? The rest is history, right? I sat next to this person in my class when I was a sophomore. I never met her before, but she was there, or I never met him. And we started talking. And as they say, what? The rest is history. Those are unplanned events. Most of us actually encountered our spouses in ways that were unpredictable or unseen in advance. And think, when you were 15 years old, if somebody would try to predict where you would end up 40 or 50 years later. Think it could have been possible? There's so much unpredictability that's associated with going through life that trying to make these predictions really early in life puts us into a lot of probability situations. Now, we're going into the next chapter, which is the second chapter. And Al, I wish we were here, but he can't come till next week to talk about this. There are 3 personal stories in Al's life that are filled with unpredictability. Really, actually 4. The first one is Al's sister Bernice. Bernice is her name. She goes by Bernie. And they were 2 children
who both Al and his sister Bernice got polio when they were young. Sister Bernice, to this day, is paralyzed from the hip on down to her toes on the right side of her body. But she went on to do amazing things, and she started out by walking with a limp, then she used a cane and crutches, and now she's confined to a wheelchair, because polio can reverse as you get older, and a lot of the early symptoms can come back even more drastically than they did when you were young. But she went on to become a lawyer. She's married. She has a family. And she is a national chess bridge champion. She has got more bridge points over the years so that she's a grandmaster, which is as high as you can go in bridge. So here's a person who was born with polio, spent her entire life challenged in walking, and yet ends up with these enormous accomplishments. And Al never had a problem with his polio at all. He came back and have no physical dysfunctions as a result of it, but still has done actually quite well for himself in life as well. Uncle Al. Al Brunsting is named after his uncle. His uncle is his father's brother. And he piloted a B-17 in the Second World War. And he had a squadron in 1942 that was going from England to Germany and Europe, dropping bombs on the Germans. And when his squadron, this was 1942, so it's still relatively early in the war before these so-called flying fortresses, B-17s, were protected with fighter pilots to escort them to Europe and back. Uncle Al's airplane, or B-17, was the only one in the squadron that was shot down. All the rest made it back to England. And most of the pilots in that squadron lived to outlast the war. But Al's uncle, Uncle Al, did not. He and his crew went down, they all died, and later they were awarded the Congressional Medal of Medal of Honor posthumously for their bravery during that event. Why that B-17 and not another? Why did the German pilots see that one and not the other? And they went over a flak field, and the B-17 was bombarded with a flak, and it crippled the airplane. And what happened is the squadron was flying back in close formation. Al's plane dropped below the squadron level and clearly visible by the German fighter pilots. And they flew in and shot it down. Why did that happen? The answer is it a random event? It sure was. Now, here's the last one, and then we'll take some questions. This is Al's younger brother named Danny. And Danny died of leukemia just before his fifth birthday. Al's father was a minister in a Reformed church, and his wife struggled to make sense of why this happened and what God-given purpose could be served by the death of such a young and innocent child. This is not a unique circumstance. There are a number of children who sadly have these kinds of genetic diseases that show up very early in life and for which there is no solution, no cure. And it is very, very sad. St. Jude's, as you know, specializes in working with children who have cancer, and their success rate is very high, but a number of children also do not make it, even to their fifth or sixth year of life. It's a tragedy. And that happened in Al's family. His sister contracted lifelong challenges as a result of a polio that Al had, and he didn't. His uncle Al was shot down over basically the flying in the Second World War over the English Channel, and his younger brother passed away. There is a lot of randomness in his family. There's also another random act that's very important. He met his wife when he was going to college. Completely unpredictable. She was at Hope College, and he was at Calvin College. One is for girls, one is for boys. At least it was in those days, right? They went on a date together where the girls from Hope got together with the boys from Calvin. And voila, as they say, it happened. The magic happened. They've been married for many, many decades right now, and they have two lovely children and four great-grandchildren, right? Out of life circumstances for him alone came tragedy at many levels. But also, his life was fixed with extraordinary blessings. that were the direct result of much of the randomness that occurred in his life as well. And I suspect that all of us have stories we can tell where randomness played a very positive role in our lives. The unpredictable, the unexpected. You got that call and got that job, or whatever it was. Or you had a beautiful child that grew up and developed wonderfully and made you proud and happy. Those kind of events, as well as events that cause sadness and sorrow. This is where we start. Life is a combination of both of these, and the question we want to ask is, where does God fit into this? Where does God fit into the good things that happen to us, and where does God fit into the bad things that happen to us within a universe that is highly structured, where it's much easier to make sense out of a God who created this universe than it seems to be out of the random events that occur within that structure and over which we may or may not have control and yet have a huge influence in the way our lives play out. So if you come for the next five sessions, we're going to address this question. Al will be here for the next 2 weeks, and I want to say, Al, answer this question, if you can, as quickly as possible. If not, we will continue for six sessions, and at the end, the sixth session, we're going to address the question of where God fits into the random activities that happen in our lives. 5 minutes left. Question. That's a good question. Do animals have free choice? A lot of the debate is whether or not animals are motivated by external stimuli. So if your dog goes to one member of your family and not the other, there's some external stimuli that is reinforcing that pattern. That's a huge debated issue. Whether or not dogs actually have cognitive abilities like we do, and can step back and say, shall I go to brother A or brother B or brother C? That's highly debated, and most people who work in the field of biological science, especially on the brain, do not perceive that non-humans have that kind of capacity for choice. It doesn't mean that they don't react to stimuli, but choice operates at a significantly different level in terms of the way we understand the human capacity for free will. That's a good question. Boy, girl, I'd like to keep it even balanced here. Is there any female, any women want to make comments or not? We'll don't mean to say no, but okay, yes, sir. Frank.
Would you remind us a little bit about how you and Al came together? Was that random? And how? What's your
The answer is yes, I guess. I don't think so. No. I had a friend. Yeah, it's the answer my friend used to give was But anyway, the answer to that is Al and I were in a part of a Sunday school class back in the Chicago area, Naperville, Illinois. It was called Sojourners. We just met and talked and so on. And then I published a few books, and I had a friend who once said, you know, this last book, you need to do more on science because there's a component of this book that's missing. And I said, you know, you're right, but I'm not the person to do it because I don't have the background. But Al and I had developed a very, very wonderful, warm friendship by then. And I have the so-called humanistic skills, or the, if you think of it on, he calls them the touchy-feely soft skills. And he's a PhD physicist, and he has all these, what he calls the STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, and math skills. And then at the end of the conversation that I once had with another friend who said, "What you should really think about this." And I said, yes, we'll try to maybe write another book, but I need to find somebody that I can work with. And I went immediately to Al, because I knew of his background and his skill. It literally was a random event. It was a question that said, have you included this, or why didn't you? And at that particular point, I said to Al, would you like to help me write a book? On science and faith, science and religion. He said he thought about it for a second and a half and then said yes. So once we had a partnership, we have 7, 8, 9 years now of thinking through these processes together. and he will be here next week, and he is good. He's really sharp. So if you've been here before and had a chance to hear him, you know that, and he'll be here for a couple of weeks. But that's how it happened. It really was a lot of randomness. But once we got together and started using our head to try to figure this out, there was a great deal of uncertainty about what we were going to write, and eventually we focused and got it going.
You tell Al that he has the hard skills and you have the harder skills.
Oh, there you go. Okay, yes, question. We
Tom?
Have one more question.
Well, Tom, I think...
Oh, okay. I guess we don't
That's
have
a
one.
Good place to transition for this week.
Okay.
And we'll get back to next
Now, was this a random
week.
Event?
Mm-hmm.
Or was this planned?
This was planned.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.